There is a debate within the existing academic moral philosophy literature involving people like Dancy and some number of others, in which the question is, at times, are moral judgments necessarily particular? Is there something necessarily contextual, necessarily detailed, necessarily non-repeatable, necessarily individualized about moral judgments? And there are people from the, whether it be from the Kantian tradition or from a rule consequentialist position, who would be on the other side of that. So I don't want to talk about the philosophical debate as such, but for those of you who are in or near those debates, I certainly intend to be in the vicinity myself. But and when I say be in the vicinity, although I am talking about stereotyping and related issues, ultimately what I am talking about is the question whether, as a purely theoretical matter or as an applied matter, we necessarily do or should make policy decisions or various other decisions that we make on as individualized a basis as we can, or whether it is necessary or desirable, not the same thing, necessary or desirable that we make our decisions, our policy decisions, and our individual decisions in categories, in groups, in chunks, however we want to call it. Okay. What's a stereotype? Let me start by defining the terms a little bit. I want to define a stereotype as initially an empirical generalization. When I say an empirical generalization, therefore, I put aside analytic truths. I will leave to others the analysis of and debates about a bachelor is an unmarried man. I am not interested in those categorical statements such as that that are true by definition. I'm also not interested, or I might be interested in, but at least outside of my definition of a stereotype, are those things that are empirically and contingently true, but turn out to be universally true. So, for example, I borrowed a poster on the way in from just outside the door. There is a public lecture here or somewhere in the vicinity on March the 5th, entitled The Black Swan. The title of the lecture is designed to make reference to one of the standard philosophical examples. All swans are white. Back during a time when very few people had been to Australia and therefore very few people had seen black swans, it was thought that all swans were white, even though whiteness was not a definitional, was not definitional of what it was to be a swan. Back when people did not realize that there were black swans, there was a definition of a swan that did not include whiteness, or to be somewhat more accurate, did not include non-blackness. And therefore, it was logically possible for there to be black swans, even though people did not think there were any. Then black swans were discovered, now it has become an example for some number of other things. So let me substitute for that classic example, the example of swans that weigh less than 100 pounds, or more accurately, swans that weigh more than 100 pounds. There are none. I'm pretty sure there are none. So if I were to make the statement, all swans weigh less than 100 pounds, I would be making a statement that, as far as I and everyone else in the room knows, is universally true, but not necessarily universally true. We might discover huge swans, just as we discovered black swans. That would be okay. It would be okay for swanness. Whether it be not okay for some number of other things, we'll put aside. I'm not interested in that either. I'm interested, therefore, in the empirical generalizations that are not only not necessarily true, but are not universally true. Of the variety of Swiss cheese has holes, German wine is sweet, Oxford is dreary in January. All of these statements, especially given that I am not putting into those statements words like all or every or always, all of those statements used without words like all or every or always are still statements that are probabilistically true. They are generally true as a matter of how we normally use the language. They are entirely appropriate statements to make, even as we recognize that some Swiss cheese does not have holes, some German wine is not sweet, and so I am told occasionally it is not dreary in Oxford in January. So, those are the ones that I am interested in as, let us say, lead in to thinking about stereotypes. Now let's get a little bit closer to stereotypes. These are probabilistically reliable empirical generalizations. But not only are they empirical generalizations, it is also important that they be probabilistically reliable. So take a somewhat different empirical generalization, or several of them. Capricorns are handsome. Gay men lack courage. Both of these are, if I can add a slight twist to a statistician's term that has a slightly different meaning, but it's close enough for my purposes. These are spurious. That is, it's not only that they are not universal, that knowing that something is an X tells us nothing about whether it is a Y, common beliefs notwithstanding. If I know that someone is a Capricorn, that doesn't help me one bit in determining whether they are handsome or whether they are any of the other things that the normal astrological guides would tell us Capricornness is indicative of. It is widely believed that Capricornness is indicative of some number of personal characteristics, just as it is widely believed that being a gay man is indicative of lack of physical courage. Both of those are spurious. That is, we have no more information about the right-hand side of the equation for knowing what is on the left-hand side of the equation, unlike the ones that I just mentioned. If I ask you the question, does this cheese have holes? And then I say, it's Swiss cheese. At least you have some indication that it is more likely to have holes than if I tell you only that it is cheese, or if I tell you that it is some other kind of cheese. Is this wine sweet? If I tell you it's German, it is more likely to be sweet than it would have been, or than it would have been if you hadn't had the additional piece of information. Germanness gives you a piece of information that increases the probability of sweetness. Swissness gives you a piece of information that increases the probability of wholeness. Oxford gives you a piece of information that increases the probability of January juriousness in ways that the other examples I mentioned didn't. So, we have this category of stereotypes, empirically reliable but non-universal generalizations. One more addition to my definition. When I say reliable, it does not have to be the case that most of the X's are Y. It only has to be the case that something is more likely to be a Y than if it is an X than would otherwise be the case. So take a widely discussed example in the US. I don't want to spend too much time on it. I have a chapter on it in the book. It's actually quite charming and engaging. Widely discussed in the US, a little bit discussed here, a little bit discussed Germany and a few other countries. The question of whether pit bull dogs should be regulated because of their aggressiveness. It turns out that the majority of pit bulls are not dangerously aggressive. Yet, although the majority of pit bulls are not dangerously aggressive, a dog about which we initially know nothing is one that can be predicted to be more likely dangerously aggressive if we know it is a pit bull than otherwise, even though the vast majority of pit bulls are not dangerously aggressive. Pit bullness gives us information about the likelihood of dangerous aggressiveness, even though the majority of pit bulls are not dangerously aggressive. Now, so we now have this category, and then the question is, when should when should policy decisions be made, when should individual decisions be made, on the basis of these empirically reliable in the sense that I have just used, but non-universal generalizations. There is a common view, and the one that, in a way, frames the title of this talk. There is a common view that says that the answer to that question is never. That's the view that I want to take issue with, that's the view that I want to spend a fair amount of time talking about. Initially, I want to suggest that one of the reasons why the never does not hold up is that as a general proposition, put aside the personal characteristics of human beings, as a general proposition, it is somewhere between implausible and impossible to imagine that we could make decisions without using these kinds of empirically reliable but non-universal generalizations, and indeed, almost all of the rules we encounter are of this variety. The typical speed limit, for example, is a rule that is designed to reflect a background justification of increasing highway safety. So when the speed limits here are in kilometers, right? Yes? No? Still miles? Okay. I know there is something. Okay. So if the typical, I have not driven an automobile since I have been here, which I consider at least, that's one of the reasons why I am here now. Take the typical speed limit that would say 70 miles per hour, designed to reflect a background justification of increasing highway safety. It is based on the proposition, it is based on a stereotype, it is based on a generalization that for most drivers under most conditions, it is unsafe to drive faster than that. So suppose on a brand new, well-conditioned motorway, it is a clear, dry Sunday morning. I'm an extremely skillful driver and can prove it. with a perfect driving record. I am driving in my quite new, very good condition, very safe automobile with no traffic anywhere to be seen on a totally straight stretch of road when I am stopped by a police officer for going 80 miles per hour. Police officer pulls me over and says, you were going 80 miles an hour. This was a 70 mile an hour zone. You were going to have to pay a fine. I respond, excuse me, officer, I don't think you understand. The speed limit is designed to reflect the background justification of increasing safety, but it's not perfect. In fact, it's designed for average drivers under average conditions, including day and including night, in average cars and everything else. I have a perfect driving record. You can look it up. I have a car that can easily go far faster than that safely. It is dry. It is clear. There's no traffic. It's Sunday morning. I think you have stopped me mistakenly. We know what would happen. I use the example to indicate that in an important sense, the speed limit law is based on the kind of generalization that, other than a terminological difference, we might think of as a stereotype. Rules fit the form of if X, then Y, where the idea is Y is the right treatment for most but not all X's. But even though Y is the right treatment for most but not all X's, the nature of a rule is that Y will be applied to all X's even though it is only the right treatment for most of them. Let me give a brief but I think moderately easily understandable example from American corporate law. This would normally be a room clearer, but the room door is closed. There is a statute in American securities law called Section 16B of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. It provides that if you are an officer or a director or the owner of more than 10% of the stock of a company, you cannot buy and sell that company's stock within a 6-month period. Nor can you sell and then buy within a 6-month period. There's a reason for this. Here in the US, as here, insider trading is a problem. Most inside traders are quite crafty people. It's hard to figure out who the inside traders are. Therefore, the rule that I have just described says if we keep all people who are likely to have inside information from engaging in what are called short swing transactions, that is, in and out within a moderately short period, we will make it really hard for people to engage in inside trading. As you might guess, if you only own 9% of the stock, at least for purposes of this rule, you can engage in all the insider trading you want, and this rule is not going to get you. Similarly, if you own 11% of the stock and have absolutely no inside information whatsoever and buy and sell within a 5-month and 28-day period, you have broken the law even if you have no inside information at all. Rules like this are all around us. I assume that most of you at some point or another have traveled to the US. I feel sorry for those of you who have to endure American customs for non-Americans these days. All I can tell you is it's no walk in the park for an American arriving at Heathrow either. But when you fill out the little blue form, One of the things you have probably seen on the little blue form is that you must declare it if you are coming into the United States, or leaving for that matter, with more than $10,000 in cash or negotiable securities. Because you can actually do it as long as you declare it, this has nothing to do with currency regulations. This is all about getting drug dealers and money launderers. Nevertheless, if you have this amount of money and don't declare, you have broken the law, even if you are not a drug dealer, even if you are not a money launderer. Indeed, I use this example. Because I had a somewhat bizarre occurrence about 10 years ago or so. I was sent by the same government that wants me to report this, the United States of America. I was sent by the United States of America to do a little bit of work on legal developments, in particular media law in Estonia shortly after an Estonian independence in the early 1990s. At the time, I was told that translation services might be needed, drivers might have to be hired, and the hotels which charged Western prices would not take credit cards and would not take traveler's checks. So as a consequence of this, the governments of the United States of America gave me $12,000 in cash. I stuck it into the front pocket of my blue jeans, and like the good law-abiding citizen that I am, I declared it. I filled out a form upon leaving the United States, and for the next several years, I received a letter from the government of the United States asking me to report all sorts of other things that other citizens would not have to report. I was clearly on the people in need of careful watching list, just because I had complied with the law. And indeed, it was not even my money. It was the United States' money. Okay, so we're now past the rule idea. The very idea of a rule requires that we make decisions on the basis of these kinds of empirical generalizations. Now you say, yes, but what about people? What about these generalizations about people, about the personal characteristics of people? So I don't have one in front of me, but I assume that it is a requirement, for example, for an academic post, for most academic posts at Oxford University, that one have frequently a PhD or equivalent degree, or that at the least one have some sort of formal qualification. It is a requirement, I assume, to be a surgeon in this country. I hope so, that one have a medical qualification. But of course, I assume that there are some people who would be better at performing surgery than some of the actually qualified surgeons who do not have the qualification. I assume that there are some people who would be better at being Oxford academics than some number of the people who are, who may not have any university degrees whatsoever. Should we? Say to these, when this person writes a letter to the electors, for example, I don't have any of these degrees, but I'm pretty smart and I really understand this stuff, so will you look at all of my qualifications individually? The answer to that is almost certainly no. They're not going to get past the first hurdle. They don't have the formal qualification. So too when someone shows up at the hospital and says, I am here with my patient. Can I borrow one of your operating theaters to do surgery? The question that they are not going to get to the point of demonstrate to us that you're good at doing surgery. The qualification is going to do it. This, again, probably doesn't strike anybody as particularly problematic. Then you say, yes, but these are not permanent or fixed or immutable characteristics. Anybody with the requisite whatevers can get the appropriate degrees. Anybody with the requisite whatevers that you need can get a medical qualification. What about the kinds of things that people can't change? Then, of course, we can think about some number of other categories. The one that I like to think about most in this context is age discrimination. I like to think about it most because there tends to be a surprisingly small amount of general resistance to the age-based empirical generalizations. It's also an interesting topic to talk about here. As I assume most of you know, I'll put it somewhat differently. I suspect that most of the people in this room at some point will be required to retire on the basis of age. At least one person in this room will not. That would be me. That is, the U.S. has no age-based mandatory retirement. Has not had it in about 15 years. That's a little bit complicated. There are at least some arguments that say that it's not so much based on the generalization or stereotype that once you're past 65, you can no longer be a philosophy tutor in Oxford, but rather it's designed to keep open the pipeline for future philosophers and so on. So let's think about mandatory retirement for airline pilots. In most countries, including the U.S., there's mandatory retirement for airline pilots. Depending on the country, it's 55 or 60 or 62 or 65. It is based on four pretty well-known and non-changeable empirical generalizations. Age is a good proxy for loss of visual acuity, in particular, the ability to see well under conditions of low light and high glare, or high glare. Both of those are not unfamiliar circumstances in an airplane cockpit. Age is also a good proxy for loss of hearing ability, in particular, loss of the ability to hear well against background noise. Again, for those of you who've been in a plane and picked up the earphones, when the pilot says, if you want to listen to my discussions with the control tower, and you discover there's a lot of background noise and you can't figure out what's going on. It's also a good proxy for slowing down of reflexes, and perhaps the most interesting, age is a good proxy for non-medically identifiable in advance stroke or heart attack. That is, holding constant blood pressure, cholesterol level, and everything else, people over the age of 60 are more likely to have strokes than people under the age of 60. People over the age of 60 are more likely to have a stroke, even if none of the high blood pressure, high cholesterol, or any of the other indicators are present. The airline authorities tend to take the view that having a stroke while you were driving an airplane is not a good idea, and therefore all of these produce the view that there must be mandatory retirement. Now, then the question is there something problematic about this? Again, I use the example to suggest that at least my intuition, and I display it as an intuition, is that the answer is no. Some people would say that the answer ought to be yes. Some people would say we ought to test all of the individual pilots. But then I want to ask those of you who think that we ought to test all individual pilots, after all, there aren't that many pilots, and that if we ought to test all individual pilots rather than using the stereotype, rather than using the empirical generalization. If you believe that, then consider the following examples. Suppose that someone who is 13 years old decides that he or she wants a driver's license. I assume that the minimum age for getting a driver's license in this country is somewhat older than 13. Suppose you have a 13-year-old who is tall for his or her age, tall enough to, as tall as most of the people who have driver's licenses, and is very responsible and wants to be able to demonstrate it. The 13-year-old comes to whatever you call the registry of motor vehicles here and says, yes, it's true that I'm only 13, but I'm tall enough, I'm smart enough, and I'm really, really responsible, and I'm happy to have you give me a test to show that. It's not going to happen. If you think that the mandatory retirement by age is some evil thing called age discrimination, then you ought to think about why it is different if we are making 13-year-olds ineligible to drink or ineligible to drive or somewhat more complicated, ineligible to vote. It may be that this is an area of largely non-pernicious, but non-changeable. That is, those of us who are over 60, we can't go back. This may be bad news for the other people in the room over 60. That's it. We're there. We can't change this. We're not going to become under 60. It is in that sense, for those of us over 60, as immutable as gender or race or some number of others. Now, there's still a little bit of a response to that example. It may not carve out a particular segment of the population. That is, it is almost universally true that all human beings fall into one of two categories: over 60 or hoping to get there. And if all human beings are either over 60 or hoping to get there, then it may be that age discrimination in this sense is less exclusionary than some other forms of discrimination. Now, at this point, you might think that I am going to say, once we are at this point in the analysis, once we are in this point in marching through a range of different intuitions, then therefore we should recognize that it is okay to stereotype on the basis of race or gender or ethnicity or national origin. I'm not going to say that. I don't believe that. The reason I use all of these other examples is to suggest that if I think, that certain forms of so-called racial profiling or gender stereotyping or the like are wrong, even when they are empirically justified, they are wrong not because they are spurious, and they are wrong not because they are stereotypes, and they are wrong not because they are generalizations, but they are wrong because they are generalizations or stereotypes of a certain variety, and then we need an account or a theory or whatever about why that is. It turns out, as some of you probably know better than I do, that one of the things that makes that an important issue is that we have already arrived at the point of recognizing that there are some number of ethnically and racially related diseases and there are controversies about the extent to which there should be testing or screening by race or by ethnicity for diseases that are disproportionately an issue for people of certain races or ethnicities. So, for example, it's well known that high blood pressure is disproportionately in my country located within African Americans. It is also the case, and here my science might be a couple of years obsolete. If so, I will apologize. But I believe it is also the case that women of Eastern European, Ashkenazi, Jewish origin are slightly more likely than other women to have a certain genetic makeup that makes it slightly more likely that they will have breast cancer. So again, then there are the questions and debates about the extent to which this should be taken into account. Now, at this point, I don't have a strong view on yes or no about the examples that I have just mentioned. I do have a strong view about some of the other more routine examples of racial profiling or gender stereotyping. I have, for example, a view about the impermissibility of gender stereotyping, even when the gender stereotype is at the moment empirically accurate. So for example, suppose that we were to discover, and there are certainly instances of this, suppose we were to discover that some company or some airline, let's stick with the airline industry, that some airline said women cannot be baggage handlers. And they said, women cannot be baggage handlers because in order to be a baggage handler, you have to be able to lift heavy suitcases. It turns out that lifting heavy suitcases requires upper body strength. It turns out that upper body strength, that gender is very imperfect but non-spurious predictor of upper body strength. So some airline says, men only, and we will use gender as a proxy for upper body strength. I believe that's wrong. But I don't believe it's wrong because it's spurious. I believe it's wrong despite the fact that it's non-spurious. We can imagine a few reasons for this. One would be, in some areas, maybe not this one, in some areas, current differentials are themselves the product of previous discrimination. So one of the first gender discrimination cases in the United States Supreme Court was a case called Reed versus Reed, decided by the United States Supreme Court in 1970. The state of Idaho, I believe it was, said that only men could be, under certain circumstances, the administrator or an executor or the executor of the estate of a deceased person. In 1970, it is almost certain that gender was a non-spurious proxy, non-spurious predictor for the financial and business kinds of skills and training that one would want for an executor. But it is certain that the reason that women were less likely to have it in 1970 than men was a history of previous discrimination in which men were steered into finance and accounting and business, while women were steered into various other occupations or no occupations, so that even if it were true in 1970 that gender was a good proxy for this, or at least a non-spurious proxy for this, it might itself have been the product of discrimination rather than something inevitable. Moreover, there are enough instances in which qualifications may be erected as a in order to further discrimination for other reasons. That we might be suspicious of this, even though there is some plausible justification. Therefore, it turns, we might say, or we might ask the question, how much of being a baggage handler actually requires that you be able to lift bags in a way that the gender differentials about upper body strength actually make a difference. And we might discover, as we've seen from some number of examples of discrimination, that it turns out that the answer is not very much, and that the qualification is added not as a way of getting the best baggage handlers, but as a way of keeping women out. And in some number of instances, we see things used in just this way. All I am suggesting here, then, is that once we start thinking about examples like that, once we start thinking about instances in which we ought to profile by national origin, profile by ethnicity, profile by race at airports or the like, none of which I would do, we don't get anywhere, or we may not get far enough by saying it's simply spurious. Because if we say it's simply spurious, we are likely, for those of us who have my beliefs, be undercut by the data. In some number of instances, the data would suggest that using it in some instances is non-spurious, but it might be, as with the example of gender and with some number of others, that we should treat it, I would treat it, as impermissible anyway, partly because of what it reflects, partly because of whom it might exclude, partly because of the way it sets people apart as separate segments of a population. I'll finish with one final example. And I'll finish by departing the example of individuals again, and just think about public policy. If we go back to the couple of hundred years, more or less, in Bentham's work on the penal code, he talked about an interesting category of offenses called presumed offenses. I prefer to call them indicative of offenses. That is, should it be a crime to do something that's not harmful in itself, but may indicate probabilistically that you have done something else? Bentham had two examples for this that came, he claims, I have not done the background research, that come roughly from the English law of the time. One of them is the example of being in possession of shipwrecked property with altered markings. Bentham said, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with having shipwrecked property with altered markings, most commonly a ship with a changed name. But it turns out that almost all of the ships with changed names were stolen. So therefore, we will simply make it a crime to be in possession of a ship with altered markings. Bentham also gave the example in which it was at the time taken to be conclusive evidence of infanticide that someone had given birth to a child under circumstances in which the child's birth was not reported and the child was not now, could not now be located. That was taken to be conclusive evidence of infanticide, even though the indications were imperfect. Jump ahead, we see examples of this now. It is in a number of American states taken to be conclusive evidence that you are a drug dealer if you are in possession of more than 28 grams of cocaine. It's a minor crime to be in possession of less than 28 grams, a huge crime to be in possession of more, because of the assumption that almost everyone who has more than 28 grams of cocaine is a dealer. I end with this example just to suggest that I cannot imagine a regulatory system, a policy system, or even a criminal justice system that did not engage in these kinds of probabilistic assumptions. And for those of us who think that most forms of ethnic or racial profiling or stereotyping are wrong, we need to get over thinking that that is because there's something wrong with stereotyping or profiling, and focus on the fact that it's the race or the gender or the ethnicity that we have to focus on, rather than the idea that there is something intrinsically wrong with making decisions based on probabilistic but imperfect generalizations. I'll stop at that. The floor is yours.